This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Right now, Olga is doing some investigations. She was reportedly in a library someplace, doors closed. I want to introduce my buddy, Scott Lucas, and we have the podcast, Eurofile, going to be stepping in for the next few episodes. Our spaces is called Eurofile at 6. Today, our focus is on Ukraine, and we have two very, very special guests. The first guest is Olga Tokariuk, and Olga is a non-resident fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis, that's CEPA. You know, her work is fundamental also as a journalist.
Hi, Monique. Hi, Scott. Hello, Alexander.
Our second guest is Alexander Kara, and he's a diplomat, multinational relations at the Maidan in Ukraine, and an advisor to the Minister of Defense.
Alexander Kara, how are you today?
Perfect, thank you. And how are you?
Great. Alexander and Olga, we are almost at 6 months of Russia's aggression, okay, renewed aggression against Ukraine. And I'd like to begin with a very general, okay, your general reflections of where we are today. And let's say, could you have imagined that it had gone this far for so long, let's say up until now? Alexander, let's start with you, and then Olga. Okay, I'd like your reflections as well. Alexander?
Well, first of all, let me start with a bit remote event that happened 14 years ago. Russia provoked aggression against Georgia. And at that time, the world just swallowed this aggression, and which is, well, absolutely unacceptable in terms of the liberal order and securing, or at least if you are talking about the, overcoming on the legacy of the Soviet past and so on and so on. And secondly, which is most dangerous thing that happened, after a couple of years, the United States reset its relations with Russia, and then Angela Merkel in Germany, as a powerhouse of Europe, pushed a partnership for modernization program that allowed Russia to modernize first and foremost their military, and then addict the whole of Europe on gas, oil, and Russian money. So the events that we see this year, I mean, the all-out war that Russia unleashed on Ukraine, were laid out right in 14 years ago, because the West in the whole international community didn't act in the proper manner. Secondly, which is more important, the most important thing that happened during these weeks, but it's sort of a sign of where the situation is going. It's a report of Amnesty International, which brought outrage in Ukraine for some reason. But what's important, that the leadership of the organization, even though they apologized before Ukrainians, they didn't, recall their report, providing Russia with an excuse to continue shelling Ukrainian civil infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and other things. So this seems something really terrible that is happening and is shaping the whole situation. And one of the members of the board of Amnesty was filmed by CBS talking about arms supply to Ukraine, which, as she said, there is no knowledge of where these arms are going. But at the same time, on the second frame there was a quote that up to 30% of the arms find out its way to the front line, and nobody knows where the rest. And it's a dangerous, narrative of that stop the war, meaning stop supplying arms for Ukraine, and certainly it will mean that we will be not able to defend ourselves. So this campaign is terrifying, and it's important because it was on some time, but we see a new push, and especially before this winter crisis. And possibly I should bring the CPAC in the United States and the Trump speech and all those Trumpinians who are voicing, let's say, their dissatisfaction with the Obama administration, or sorry, Biden administration policies, and they would be eager to stop this war and agree on something with Russia at the expense of Ukraine. So all those things are really threatening us while we see our cities being demolished, while Russians are reinforcing their forces in the south. And certainly we see a lot of destruction and torture and killing and other things, and it's not going to stop with this moratorium or stop of providing us with arms. So all those things are really worrying us at the moment.
Yeah, indeed. Olga, your reflections, okay, on these past months, and you put out a tweet, okay, where you were talking about, I believe, the renewed, okay, bombardments and different things like that, you know, just recently. Can you talk about your reflections first? And then we'll also get into a lot of what, okay, Alexander's brought up, but I'm sure that this is a really important point with all of the Ukrainian, okay, let's say effort, the war effort itself, is that what is happening in the disinformation and influence ops, because these are extremely important right now because they're aimed towards the West. But Olga, let's go with your reflections first.
Yes. Well, I think if, you know, we are summing up and kind of analyzing this 6 months of war, of full-scale war, Russian war against Ukraine, I think several conclusions can be drawn. So the first conclusion is that Ukraine didn't collapse. Ukraine is standing, Ukraine is resisting, and Ukraine is actually regaining some lost territory, which is very important. So I'm not only referring to Kyiv, Chernihiv, Sumy region that has been liberated back in April, much to the surprise of a lot of, you know, pundits in the West who were predicting the collapse of Kyiv, if not in 3 days, but then in several weeks, were speaking at length about this convoy, Russian long mile convoy approaching Kyiv. So it turned out, you know, in fact, that Russians had huge problems with their military. But not only this, is that the strength of the Ukrainian resistance of both Ukrainian military and also civilians were also heavily underestimated in the West. So it not only is about, you know, the misjudgment and misreading of the strengths of Russian armed forces, but also the underestimation of the Ukrainian resistance and of Ukrainian capabilities to stand up to Russian aggression on all levels of society, not just militarily. So I think, like, this is the conclusion number two. You know, first, Ukrainian collapse. Two, the capabilities of Russia were overestimated and the capabilities of Ukraine were underestimated. And I think, you know, departing from these two conclusions, we can somehow shape the policy and also the approach to what happens next. I think this should be kept in mind when taking the decisions in the West on what to do next. Because, you know, judging on what has been happening in Ukraine in these 6 months, but also in the past 8 years, we can say with confidence that Russia will not stop until it is stopped. Russia will continue, destroying Ukrainian cities, civilian targeting and civilian objects in the territories that are not under its control. And then on the territories that are under its control, hopefully temporarily, it will continue an even more repressive campaign of terror, of intimidation, of kidnappings, extrajudicial killings. You know, we do not know exactly what is happening in the occupied Kherson region and other regions of southern Ukraine. But the reports that we are getting from there are really chilling. You know, they make the blood chill in our veins, because these are the reports of people going missing, of illegal detention centers where people are held for weeks and months without any due trial, where they are heavily tortured, abused, killed. We also see what Russians are doing in Donbass. These recent images of Ukrainian prisoners of war who are castrated. A horrible image that emerged recently of a Ukrainian probably soldier, we don't know, his head cut off and impaled in the city of Popasna in Luhansk region. So these are, you know, terrible atrocities that that are happening on a daily basis, and they are bound to happen until Russia is stopped. And I think what is actually, you know, maybe missing in the understanding of this war outside, that somehow there is this kind of self, you know, how should I say, this thinking that, well, okay, it's only limited to Ukraine, you know, this Russia will only limit itself to Ukraine. It will not dare to attack NATO countries. It will not dare to go further. Which I think, you know, it's a flawed and it's a very kind of naive line of thinking, because we've seen that Russia's appetite only grows if it is not countered, if it's not, you know, if it does not meet a strong and forceful response. And already those voices that you and Alexander have mentioned in the West, who are starting, you know, to doubt whether we should continue supplying Ukraine with weapons, whether, you know, we should somehow make some kind of a deal with Russia, or I don't know, also in the energy sphere where Russia is using its blackmail very heavily. Just remember the case with the turbine from Canada, right, to Germany, which Russians still didn't claim, yeah, which is still stuck there.
So it was just Germany, is it not?
Yes, yeah, it is. It was just a pretext, actually, for Russians to test the reaction of the West and to test whether the reaction is strong or weak. And they see this weakness, and they see the weakness also in the statements of Amnesty International, which illustrate that, you know, even the international organizations that are supposed to be defending human rights, they fail to distinguish, you know, between the aggressor and the victim. They put this immoral, I would say, equivalence between the aggressor and the victim. And for Russia, these are just signs, again, of the moral, you know, decadence of the West, or at least what Russia perceives as a moral decadence of the West, and of inability of the West to stand up to its values and to defend its values. So, I think we are entering this new stage of war where one, Ukrainians will try to recapture more of the occupied territory, causing huge logistical problems for Russia. We are seeing that already in the south, where Ukraine, with the help of HIMARS and other advanced weaponry that it received from the West, is really disrupting Russian supply routes. It's destroying Russian ammunition depots. It's causing huge problems for Russians in the south. This is, I think, is also somehow underreported, maybe in the foreign media, of, you know, how successful these operations are and how important these weapons that Ukraine receives from the West are for, you know, to deoccupy the south of Ukraine, to defeat Russians there, to disrupt their logistics. So Ukraine is doing that. We'll see more of that. And we'll see more hybrid war tactics from Russia. So Russia will be targeting civilians more. Simultaneously, Russia will be, you know, launching terrorist attacks, because this is what it is doing on all, you know, Ukraine's territory. Russia will resort to nuclear blackmail, as it is doing now in Enerhodar nuclear power plant. And Russia will, of course, you know, step up its influence operation, disinformation operations in the West, using its assets, using, you know, even those who might not be overtly, like, you know, paid by the Kremlin, but there are a lot of useful idiots, we call them like this, that Russia can mobilize.
Yeah. I mean, they've used a lot of these people in the past, right? We've known about the influence operations and also the capture, economic and political capture across Europe. So a lot of these people, and I'm speaking from a position here where in my own country, they don't really need, okay, to send. All they do is they know exactly how to operate and what to say, the narratives that will work on the Italian public, what is the right thing. And they've been trained over years. And this is how, okay, this is how they are to influence what is going on, you know, within Italy, to make it a, let's say, a weaker partner, okay, for Ukraine. Draghi's government has actually put out the fourth weapons package, which is fantastic. But we don't know what's going to go on. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk that the influence operation of bringing down the Draghi government is actually real. So this could happen across. These are very, very important. What we're talking about now is absolutely, you know, fundamental. Because on the one side of the war, both Alexander and both Olga, right, you guys have talked about what is happening on the ground, what Ukraine is trying to. And then there's also the other side, the partnerships. the alliance, okay, of countries that need to be united and keep united. But I see, Scott, you've got like a little question in your eyes for sure. Scott's going to come in with one of those fantastic questions right about now. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I'm just going to sort of look back before looking forward, if I can, and get the benefit. First, Alexander, then Olga on some reflections. Alexander, I know we're not supposed to deal in counterfactuals, but I still want to put this to you. Whether Putin overstepped, if we look back 6 months down the line. In other words, if Putin had gone in and simply gone for the more limited operation of trying to seize all of the Donbass in eastern Ukraine and try to take part of the south to link Donbass with Crimea, do you think the international community might have accepted that? They might have actually stood back? In other words, did Putin miscalculate by trying to go for Kyiv and trying to topple the Zelensky government immediately?
Well, thank you. It's a good question, and we can elaborate for a long period of time on that. First of all, Putin miscalculated back in 2014. Because if at that time he was using the so-called soft power, but you know, in the totalitarian states, there is no such a thing like soft power. There is propaganda, subversion, and other things. And I'm talking about not just Russia, but China as well. So he just failed to present Ukrainians with the bright future of all Slavic brothers living in, you know, in one country as the Russian Federation and so on and so on. That's why he turned to the brutal force. And he was stupid enough just to portray that it's a civil war. And he didn't, let's say, finish or didn't solve the Ukrainian problem right away. So we had some time to prepare. So that's why when he unleashed his force on the 24th of February, we've been prepared pretty much, and the West was prepared. If you have a look at the timeline, back in October or November, the United States were sure that Putin is crazy enough to proceed with his full-fledged invasion of Ukraine. And unfortunately, they miscalculated Ukrainian strengths, and they decided to strengthen our special operation forces, not the armed forces in general. Because if they had such a weaponry that we have now, like HIMARS, howitzers, and others, we would be in much better position, and we would not let Russians to conquer some more lands, and now it's difficult for us to reconquer it. So yes, he miscalculated. And I believe in the long run, we are going to see what we call the empire outrage. So he's losing his resources. He lost a lot of the best prepared men. I mean, the special forces, the VDV and other guys, the best tanks and other equipment that he had. And now with this, especially with the export control measures being imposed on Russia, he will not be able to replenish all those Wonder Waffles that he was proud of. And the only thing that they have is the blackmail, nuclear blackmail that he is trying to use directly. I mean, talking about all those new missiles, ICBMs that he's going to deploy, with a new project with Belarus that some Iskanders, nuclear capable Iskanders might be deployed to Belarus. And certainly, as that Olga mentioned, Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, because now he's blackmailing the whole world, not just Ukraine, not just our neighbors, but the whole world. So that's why, yes, he miscalculated. And he miscalculated the reaction of the West. Unfortunately, it's not as strong as we wish here in Ukraine, because we are fighting with the biggest conventional power, military power in Europe. Even though it's weak from the fighting point of view, but they have a lot of tanks, jets, and other things, and we don't have enough support from the West to just to be on the equal footing, not to mention the overwhelming power to regain our territories. So that's why I'm worrying about all those left-leaning voices, that it's better to stop providing Ukraine with arms, and the situation will be resolved somehow by peaceful diplomatic means. There is no room for diplomacy at the moment. The only room for diplomacy now is for Putin, because he might think that he's run out of time and he has not enough resources to finish the Ukrainian business at this moment. So he will need some kind of operational pause. That's why he might push this diplomatic issue through Turkey, for example, because Turks are talking, you signed the grain deal with Ukraine. Why shouldn't you talk to the Russians and find a truce or a ceasefire agreement possible to sign?
Yeah. I'll come back to that in a moment. But Olga, I also wanted to look back on another front, because you've got a tweet pinned at the top of your Twitter line, and I go back to it every day, which is on March the 1st, you said, Ukraine will win. Now, that was 5 days after the invasion. And it was after, on the very first night of the invasion, Monique and I and others were sitting there thinking the Russians are going to take Hostomel Airport. They're going to move into Kyiv. And we have to face that. You kept the faith. But I wanted to ask you specifically about whether you still have been surprised by President Zelensky. Still a relatively young political leader, less than 3 years in office. We know that there were a number of officials, government and military officials, who appear to have been collaborating with the Russians. He had to deal with that. Were you surprised at the amount of resolve that came from Zelensky and from the top of the government in those opening days?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Scott. And in fact, that piece that I have pinned in my Twitter feed, I wrote it back in November. So, this wasn't something that I said after Russians launched their full-scale invasion, but already, it was like the clouds were gathering back in fall last year. But still, it was still relevant. And I think that piece is still relevant, because in it, I outline why Russia attacked Ukraine, because it's because of Ukraine's progress, because of Ukraine's reforms, moving closer and closer to be a democracy, to be a prosperous state, very different from Russia. And that, what I think, is the main motivation behind this Russian full-scale invasion. And also, I said in that piece that Ukrainians will resist, that Ukrainians will not give up, that they will fight, and that Russians will need to resort to huge scale of repressions, like Stalin-era repressions, to crush the Ukrainian spirit. And that's actually what we are seeing now in the occupied territories. They are really using the Stalin playbook methods to crush the Ukrainian resistance there. So, and answering your question, whether I was surprised by the strength of President Zelensky and his reaction, well, in fact, I expected such, strong resistance and resilience on behalf of the Ukrainian society, on behalf of the Ukrainian military forces. But yes, I must admit that I was surprised by how well President Zelensky and the government in general of Ukraine handled this situation, at least, in the initial phase of it. So, President Zelensky, as you said, is not a very experienced politician. He's been in office for less than 3 years at the moment of Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And in the very first days and hours, I think, of this invasion, he has done several things that defined the course of this war, and that kind of, defined also this, gave an example to both Ukrainians and the world of what Ukraine is and how Ukrainians will fight. So, of course, the famous phrase that "I need ammunition, not a ride" is something that became, a motto of this war of Ukraine resistance. We now see it printed on t-shirts. We see it, appearing on graffitis all over the world. And I think in this phrase, there is so much, because it's really, with this simple phrase, several words, he managed to convey the message that Ukrainians are not going to give up, that Ukrainians will stand up, that they will resist, because this is an existential battle. You know, it's not a battle for some part of Ukrainian territory or, you know, something minor. This is really a battle for survival of Ukraine as an independent state and of Ukrainians as, you know, a group, as a nation, because Russians make it clear. And the more war drags on, the more clear messages are coming from Russia that this is about the extermination of Ukrainians as a nation. This is about the destruction of Ukraine as an independent state. And then once they've done with Ukraine, they will move further and further to, you know, attack other countries that they see as enemies. And basically, it's all democracies. It's just that some democracies they perceive as weaker, so they can attack them, and some other democracies, you know, they do not dare, at least for now, to do that. But their rhetoric, it clearly indicates that's the direction that they want to take. And coming back to, you know, President Zelensky and his role, I think it's also twofold. So not just President Zelensky is the one who kind of motivates the Ukrainians, who inspires them to resist, but it's actually the other way around too. And it's very important. I think one of the strengths of Zelensky is that he's able to listen to the people, to capture the mood of the society and to convey that in his own actions and rhetoric. And of course, that combined with the very skilled communication team, with the work of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who've done a great job in addressing, you know, in tailoring the message of Ukraine to different audiences. When President was speaking to the parliaments in different countries, he had the same message, but expressed it with different words, citing some historical examples from the history of the country that he was addressing to. And that, you know, that's an amazing also communication job. But I think like what really kind of what is special about Zelensky is not only he is leading the people, but he's also expressing somehow the spirit and the resistance and the resilience of Ukrainians. So it works both ways, and that's very important.
Thanks so much. So we've covered sort of the past. I wonder if we could look forward. Let me just ask each of you about a couple of the military fronts. Looking at it, say, from the southern front right now.
Well, it's difficult to predict what's going to happen for the reason. From one hand, President Zelensky need to deliver something to the Ukrainian public and to the Western backers that we are successfully using and employing all those means provided to us, like HIMARS, HARVARDS, and other stuff. From the other hand, our military so far were wise enough not to be driven by political agenda. And they've been trying to push slowly Russians because, you know, they understand that we have less manpower. We have less, tanks and other offensive equipment. That's why we are trying to leverage all those strength points that we have against the Russians that outnumbered us. So that's why I cannot say that we will be able to, free the lands of South from Russian occupiers, and especially given that the Russians they installed their units into the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and they are using and blackmailing the whole world. So that's why it's one of the things that will be restraining our operations in the South. But anyway, we haven't made any mistakes from the military point of view because we were not driven by this, you know, thrust of victory and other things. And I believe that Ukrainian nation is waiting for some victories, but it's not so impatient to push Zelensky and the military, you know, to make some mistakes with the aim to have a good picture.
Oh, let me ask you: do you expect the line can be held in Donetsk, so that you have this symbolic resistance in Donetsk? Or do we have to possibly face the fact that Russia may continue to advance gradually in the east before we get to a position where the lines can be stabilized?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to answer this question because I'm not a military strategist. I'm not a military expert. So I'm reading a lot of sources and I'm basing my conclusions, you know, on that, on their opinions. But just to add to what Alexander said about the South, yeah, I want to add some more points. You know, the difficulty with liberating Kherson and, you know, other parts of southern Ukraine that are under occupation is that there are a lot of civilians who are still staying there, who have not, you know, left the region, regardless of the calls of the Ukrainian authorities to do that. And as we see, Ukrainian army is really factoring in, you know, this, the thing that they do not want to target civilians, to do harm to civilians, as contrary to what the Amnesty International claims in their report. There is actually no evidence to suggest that Ukrainians ever intentionally caused harm to civilians. Also because, well, as I said, Ukrainian army and Ukrainian civilians are, you know, they are united by the same spirit of resistance. It's not like there's some two opposing forces that do not somehow correlate. They have the same goal, and everyone is working towards the same goal in Ukraine, both the army and civilians, to liberate the country from Russian occupying forces. So that would be a major difficulty for the Ukrainian offensive, not only, you know, this inequality in terms of manpower and the fact that counteroffensive is always more difficult than defensive operation, that one needs much more manpower and weapons to go on offensive than to hold the defensive position, but also the fact that there are a lot of civilians and how to liberate those territories without causing too much harm to civilians will be, I think, a major issue. And in connection to this, I think we can expect a lot of also disinformation operations and, you know, information operations, exactly peddling this narrative that we've saw now with this amnesty report, that Ukrainians are doing harm to civilians, that the Western weapons are not making a difference, that we don't know where they end up. I think this really, all these narratives, they emerged as a consequence of really successful Ukrainian offensive operations in some part of Kherson region, because Ukrainians managed to liberate several villages there. So the more successes the Ukrainian army has there, the more and more Russians and their assets in the West will try to peddle these narratives to somehow slower this Ukrainian offensive and also undermine the support that Ukraine receives. So that said about the South, on Donbas, the situation is, of course, different there, because as you said, almost all of Luhansk region is under Russian control. They are trying to make some advances in Donetsk region, which are so far not very successful, but they are not successful also because Ukrainians are, you know, making incredible sacrifices there in terms of human lives of Ukrainian military. They are holding the positions, for example, near Donetsk, like Pisky, but all this, like holding these positions, it requires really immense sacrifices. A lot of blood is being shed. A lot of Ukrainian soldiers are dying there every day. So this maybe not, it does not make the news. It's not in the headlines, but I think there should be the awareness also, you know, abroad that yes, Ukrainians are resisting, but the price for that is huge and it's growing every day. And what can make a difference is more artillery, more weapons, because Ukrainians do not have enough firearms to counter the huge artillery fire incoming from Russian positions on their positions in Donbas. So while Ukrainians are holding those positions, much will depend on whether a lot of, you know, support arrives in terms of weapons, in terms of artillery. So while I do not doubt the resilience and resistance of Ukrainians, the real variable here is the amount of support that Ukraine receives in terms of weapons from the West. And this will ultimately define the course of this battle for Donbas.
If I may just add a couple words about the East, I am native of Donetsk, now occupied by Russia. But if you're talking about strategic importance, southern regions and Crimea is much, much important, more important than the Donbas. Donbas is important in the only way, because we have there the most fighting capable forces. And Russians were thinking that it's possible for them to encircle and to at least defeat Ukrainians on the battlefield. They failed to do this in various, let's say, stages of this war. So the East is important only as a bridgehead of Russia to advance further and further, because it's not the last war with Russia, for sure. If Russia is in the same borders that we see it now, with the same political culture and those kind of leadership that we see, it's going to be threat, existential threat to Ukraine for years to come. But if you're talking about the southern part, the Russians wanted to cut the whole of Ukraine from the sea, from both seas, Azov Sea and the Black Sea. And that's why Project Novorossiya was initiated in 2014, and it's failed at that time. So that's why we cannot allow Russians to hold in Kherson region, because they will be threatening Odessa, Mykolaiv, and the most important parts of our southern, let's say, regions of Ukraine. So that's why it's crucial, important to achieve the victory or achieve success in southern direction first, and then possibly in the east. And you have a look at the map. For the Russians, it's much easier to have this communication, and they have this supply chain to the east, because we're neighboring the Donetsk and Luhansk regions are just neighbors of Russia. But if you have a look at the south, it's just this, the narrow, I would say, like Thermopylae, the narrow channel of possibility of Russia to enforce their forces in the south. That's why it's much easier for Ukraine to control and to deny access of Russia into the southern region. So that's why the southern Kherson and Zaporizhia region are much more important than Donetsk and Lugansk.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
One thing I did want to mention is that what Olga and Alexander are talking about with the crimes that are happening, the accountability that is necessary, right? This is happening every day. Okay, there isn't one day that goes by that something is not happening. And the Russians are admitting to it, okay? Olga has a fantastic spaces that she does on Fridays, okay, that we listen into.
Yes, so every Friday I'm hosting a tour space with the title, the general title, Documenting Russian War Crimes in Ukraine. And every Friday there is a different topic. It can be filtration camps or forced disappearances or rape or crimes against the education system, crimes against the healthcare system of Ukraine. One of the recent episodes was focusing on the explosion in a penal colony in Olenivka, where dozens of Ukrainian prisoners of war were killed in what looks like a blast, like a terrorist attack, basically a blast orchestrated by Russian mercenaries from the Wagner group. So I teamed up actually with some of my old friends from an NGO, human rights NGO called Media Initiative for Human Rights, who are documenting these Russian war crimes on the ground every day. They are traveling across Ukraine. They are speaking to people. So every week we have witnesses. We have people who suffered themselves from these Russian crimes, such as, for example, we had Ukrainian prisoners of war who have been exchanged, but they told us about their time in captivity, how Russians abused them, how Russians tortured them, how Russians ripped off their nails and put their fingers into their open wounds, just to make one example, you know, of what we are talking about in these spaces. And I think it is crucial, you know, to bring these Ukrainian voices into the wider international information space. And I see it as my mission in a way to, you know, give a voice to the people who would otherwise would not be heard or would have less opportunities to be heard abroad. Because if you open any Ukrainian media, you see a lot of these stories, but unfortunately not many of them are out there in the foreign media. So I see it as my mission somehow to, you know, bring these people together, to give them voice. And it's very important for me that these are Ukrainian voices. And also the fact that I'm collaborating on this with Ukrainian human rights organizations, because one might say, okay, they are Ukrainians, they are like biased or whatever, they have an interest in all this. But no, in fact, like, these people are on the ground. They care about human rights. They care about like providing, you know, the actual picture of what is happening. And they actually criticize the Ukrainian government if there is reason for that. So they are not affiliated with the government structures. They are professionals who've been working in the human rights field for years and who can be trusted and whose expertise, in my opinion, is really the best that it is out there, that in comparison to some international organizations that we mentioned today, yeah, who clearly have an agenda. And there are, you know, so many levels and like topics to address on this, because while there might be like a lull in fighting or, you know, maybe less news from the battlefield, this war crimes and human rights abuses is something that doesn't stop, that is happening every day. Russia is committing these crimes and the human rights abuses every day. And I think it's very important to keep it in the spotlight, because human rights, it's a universal thing. It's something that all people all over the world can understand. You know, no one can be tortured. No one can be held without a trial, without charges on some, you know, on a whim, on someone's imperialist design. No one can be denied a right to life. So these things that can resonate, I think, with everyone in the world, in every country. And Ukrainians now are on the front line of, you know, defending these universal human rights. And that's why I think, you know, this Ukrainian struggle, it's so important for every person. And that's why it's important to keep the issue of war crimes, of human rights abuses in the spotlight.
Well, I completely agree that, you know, Ukraine is a really important, is something really important that happened to Europe and the whole world. I mean, we changed the course of history, of our own history, and we are providing opportunity for our neighbors, I mean, westward neighbors, to rethink all those values and pillars on which their way of life holds. And it's so important to revise even activities of those organizations, because we see that the whole international organization ecosystem does not work properly. I mean, the United Nations and other things, because, you know, we are fighting with the nuclear power, the permanent member of the UN Security Council. And we just Ukraine an opportunity to rethink about the future of the whole European project, I mean, the whole liberal world project. And certainly we would love to see Ukraine as a part of it, and not just Ukraine. I'm talking about Europe whole, free, and at a peace, including not just Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, but Belarus as well. We should not admit this country run by the dictator who is illegally holding this position. And certainly Europe should not be, resting in some clouds and thinking about peace until we are not changing the course of history in Russia as well. So that's why we need to support all those movements that are aiming at changing Russia. And then actually defeat of Russia is in the interest of each and every Russian citizen, because in this case, they will have an opportunity to relaunch their state and to live a proper life and the normal citizens, not imperials, not cannon fodder like they are now in Russia. So that's why Ukraine should be in the focus of Western media and the Western societies. What's going on here might be a sort of example how to strengthen the resilience and other inner power of the societies in the Western countries, because, you know, a lot of countries, a lot of societies, they just think that everything for granted. I mean, democracy for granted, human rights for granted, but it's not. Peace is not for granted. When we need to strengthen ourselves, and there is an only opportunity to get to this peace is through strength, through weapons, through expenditures on defense, or through the cooperation within NATO members and those who are not lucky enough, like Ukraine, beyond NATO umbrella. So we need to think about this, and the only way how to preserve our way of life, our independence and security and peace in the continent. So that's why Ukraine is important, not just for us, but I believe for our friends westwards.
Very well said.
So we're going to say goodbye to everyone.
Thank you, both of you. Just thank you so much.
Because
I mean, having to cover Syria for years, and in the end, we really failed to be able to get accountability over Syria. Ukraine gives me hope.